for ideological power in this reactionary era.
Right. Well, I want to thank both of you so much for joining me today. I'm very excited about this book and hope it does very well and it gets into lots of people's hands. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guests have been Chanel Matthews, founder of the Radical Communicators Network, former communications director for the Movement for Black Lives, currently a distinguished lecturer at City College CUNY in New York, and Marzena Żukowska, a queer non-binary Polish immigrant and co-founder of the immigrant rights groups Promoc, a longtime strategist and organizer. They've led narrative work for major movements across the US, UK, and Europe, and they are the co-editors, along with the Radical Communicators Network, of the book Liberation Stories, which we've just been discussing. The subtitle is Building Narrative Power for 21st Century Social Movements. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms.
Mr. Nana now, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
Ready for another year of grassroots community radio? With your support, it's possible. Go to kboo.fm/give or mail a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214 to contribute to KBOO's $75,000 goal for our KBOO Fights Back campaign, going now until December 31st. What better way to celebrate than gifting your loved one a KBOO membership this season?
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself, only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
Two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I want to make sure we keep our eyes on the prize and that we stay up to date with what is happening with ethnic studies here in the state of California. Many of us were dismayed when Governor Newsom signed AB 715 into law and said, yeah, you know, maybe we shouldn't make this a requirement in, you know, K to 12. And it's been pushback to say that maybe ethnic studies is quote-unquote anti-Semitic. That is something that teachers' unions and a whole bunch of other folks have viscerally disagreed with. But with that being said, there are portions of this bill that are raising concern, so much that there's a lawsuit that is aimed to block portions of it. And I wanted to bring Samir Arabi from the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, better known as AROC, to fill us in, because if things go the way as those who don't want ethnic studies would like, we could have some chilling effects, and we don't have to look to Donald Trump or the far right to be the harbingers of this. It could be right here in our backyard with the Scott Wieners of the world, but I'm going to let you kind of break things down as to what is happening with ethnic studies here in the state of California.
Yeah, thanks. It's always great to be here. And it's a fight, right? And it's a fight that's happening in the light of day, right? For everybody to see. It's laid out very directly in, you know, the Heritage Foundation document Project ESTER, right, which is the sort of companion document to Project 2025 that people talk about a lot, which, you know, for all of the Democrats hand-wringing about how terrible Project 2025 is and how it needs to be stopped and, you know, it's the rise of authoritarianism, you don't hear that about Project ESTER nearly as much. And in fact, what we've been seeing is a lot of, like, the right-wing, you know, California Dems, particularly folks like Gavin Newsom, who are tacking to the right to try to, you know, increase their so-called presidential ambitions, are playing right into the Project ESTER playbook. And a huge part of that is using the specter of anti-Semitism, you know, a real threat being faced by real Californians, but sort of weaponizing it into this discourse designed specifically to shut down conversation critical of U.S. foreign policy and what Israel, you know, Israel's genocide in Palestine. And that, you know, we can, of course, get into, like, the arc of AB 715, where it came from and where it is now. I think it's a really fascinating journey that reveals a lot about how, you know, these sort of, like, legislative machinations have led to this point and what that means about this political moment, but also really critically about how to fight it. You know, I think there's really important lessons there. And, you know, it's AB 715 has been signed into law, but the fight is far from over, very far from over.
But people who don't know, we've heard Project ESTER, but I don't think most people could tell you anything about it. Yep. Other than that it's something like Project 2025.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in very short order, Project 2025, right, was specifically about bolstering up the Trump regime and this, like, authoritarian right-wing vision of what the United States should look like. And, you know, it's sort of a legislative and like executive, you know, governance document about how the Trump administration is supposed to govern. And they've been following it like a playbook, you know, like word for word. There's trackers out there. You can see how much of it they've implemented. Project ESTER was published around the same time, and it's designed as a companion document by the same organization, the Heritage Foundation, that put out Project 2025. And it's specifically about how can we shore up support for Israel in this moment where, you know, Israel has faced record levels of disapproval in the United States, given, you know, the live streaming of this genocide and the growing power of the Palestine solidarity movement and its ability to sort of mobilize the left generally. I think they identified it as a really clear target. And basically, Project ESTER lays out very clearly the process for attacking, disassembling, and criminalizing the Palestine Solidarity Movement. That's what it's for. And, you know, there's different pieces of that, but there is a legislative piece that's specifically about we need to use, you know, the language of anti-Semitism to attack these organizations and to attack any criticism of Israel, and use that as a way to stifle the movement. It's written out plain as day. And that's, you know, more or less exactly what we're seeing in California by a group of people who call themselves the resistance to Trump, who nevertheless, right, are openly implementing this exact plan with the same donors, by the way.
Wow. So anti-Semitism is a, you know, you talk about amalgamations. That has definitely a lot of amalgamations. It used to be if you said a stereotype about somebody who's Jewish, that was anti-Semitism. You know, that you can pick up any number of derogatory words, or you could highlight any number of derogatory stereotypes. And, you know, folks ain't trying to hear that, and rightfully so. Then it became a little sticky where, you know, the first time many of us at the station heard this was we pulled a quote from the New York Times. And it said something about, I think it was Hillary Clinton was running for Senate, and the New York Times raised the question as to whether or not she would be able to satisfy her very powerful and influential Jewish constituents. And all of a sudden we got hit with anti-Semitism. And it was like, what are you talking about? And people wanted to have meetings and come through. And it was like, we took a quote from the New York Times, read this. Then they said, well, then New York Times is anti-Semitic too. And your tone and the way that you said this. And it was all kind of craziness, right? And a lot of our folks that are Jewish at the station was like, now dismiss this. But that was the first time where we saw criticism or even just questioning the policies of Israel could be construed as anti-Semitic. And since then, we've done a number of shows where, you know, if we get up here and say Benjamin Netanyahu is a bad guy, they're going to put him on the same plateau as Charlie Kirk. And you know what happened when we criticized him, right? People lost their jobs. So explain where we're at now, because this is a legislative battle, and how exactly are they trying to define anti-Semitism?
Yeah, the definition of anti-Semitism is a really core piece of what's going on with AB 715. And, you know, just to take a step back here, I think we need to hold three different things as true at the same time, right? And as movement people, right, as folks like, you know, well-versed in the left, we can hold complexity, right? That's part of our role here. One, and critically, like, anti-Semitism is a real and troubling phenomenon, right? It very much does exist. It continues to exist. I think in many ways it has, in fact, increased. And I would say a big piece of that is people on the right taking advantage of this moment, right? And taking advantage of all this, like, frustration and horror of what's going on in Palestine to change the narrative into one that is genuinely anti-Semitic, right? This idea that, like, you know... Like Israel secretly controls the U.S. government. It's like, that's not real, right? Like, that's not the way things actually work. And it's a misunderstanding of the power analysis, right, in terms of what U.S. empire is and how it functions. So that's one. We need to hold that anti-Semitism is real. Two, we also need to hold that anti-Semitism is being used in a way that not only is an accusation towards things that are in no way anti-Semitic, right? And you end up in these sort of Kafka-esque moments of, you know, like Holocaust survivors being accused of anti-Semitism because they're criticizing Israel, right? It's very clearly being weaponized in a way that not only, you know, attacks really legitimate and critical criticism of an ongoing genocide, but also makes it harder to call out real anti-Semitism because, as you said, right, you end up in this weird morass of like, well, that's just a thing people say, and then it makes it harder when it actually occurs to call it out in the way that we need to.
Right.
And then the third piece is like, you know, we also need to hold the fact that there's a focus on anti-Semitism in this moment by political elites, right, in a way that other communities don't have, you know, like the way that the California state legislature seems hyper-focused on combating anti-Semitism and like, good luck getting them to say one word about anti-Palestinian racism, right, which is endemic across the state, but no one cares about that because that's not part of the discourse of power. And so that's another like layer of it that I think we need to juggle. But just with all that context, right, we can think about how it's being applied in AB 715. And, you know, a really key piece of this is that AB 715 is referring to directly what's called the National Strategy to Combat Anti-Semitism, which I think came out of the Biden administration, that itself uses a definition of anti-Semitism designed by like Zionist organizations and power brokers, that specifically says that, you know, equation of Jews with the state of Israel is anti-Semitism and criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, which, like, you just hear those two sentences next to each other and think about it for 1 second and you realize that they just did an anti-Semitism, right? Like, you can't right. both say that, you know, if we equate all Jews with Israel, that's anti-Semitic, which, by the way, correct. And then say criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, which you just equated all Jews with Israel. Like, you can't do that.
So right, right.
That's a really key piece of the legislation that I think is really troubling. It's not the only one, but it's one of the key things that, you know, a very large coalition of human rights and civil rights organizations, you know, including AROC Action, the teachers unions, even like, you know, the school board associations are involved in this on some level, the ACLU. Have all said you need to change that, right? Like, California already has statutes on like what defines discrimination, and we should be using those because they're based in, like, you know, actual practitioners understanding these things and not a sort of politicized witch hunt. So that's right. One of several key commitments that we're asking for.
So one of the things in AB 715 was that it was going to put a monitor in the school. And I think this is where you talk about the hyper-focusedness, right? I don't recall monitors being in school for any number of groups that routinely face discriminatory practice. We could just look at our LGBT folks. You know, right. I don't know if there's any monitoring in school there. And in fact, you know, we have sitting politicians and people running for office who have no problem in saying things that are clearly anti-gay, whether it's talking about denouncing pronouns, and we can go down the whole list, right? And just discriminatory practices. But the point being, there's no monitors in school. So what is this about now that came out of AB 715 that they wanted to put a monitor or ombudsman into classroom, and how would that be working?
That's right. And, you know, I think the example you just gave is a really powerful one for how this, like, the politicization of anti-Semitism specifically, but also this hyper-focus on, you know, this perception of Jewish safety ends up being, you know, a lens through which other movement structures and other marginalized groups get thrown under the bus, right? And, like, one thing that I've seen directly related to that is, you know, because of, you know, all the Palestine stuff, right? The San Francisco school board, for example, and, you know, California generally has been like, okay, well, you know what? No political flags in the classroom, right? And that's clearly designed to stop people from showing Palestinian flags. It came out in direct response to that. But now the consequence of that is that teachers are not allowed to have rainbow flags in their classrooms, right? They're not allowed to have trans flags in their classrooms, which, like, what a horror, right? That we're taking this away from our students.
Or the Black Liberation
flag.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, you can't have a BLM flag. You can't, like, all of that has been stripped away specifically because they're scared of a Palestinian flag. And this shows, right, the way in which these sort of political structures end up endangering all of us, right? And how the Palestine struggle ends up being, whether we want it to or not, right, deeply entangled with all these other things.
So this was a question, this becomes a question then. So showing the flag, Palestinian flag, or wearing the scarf,
mm-hmm.
Is being deemed anti-Semitic?
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, again, it's sort of depending on who you ask, right? And this is part of the issue that, you know, you just mentioned with these so-called discrimination prevention coordinators, right? That's what's in the bill, that these individuals, and, you know, after pushback being like, why are you only appointing... the original position was, you know, hilariously called the anti-Semitism coordinator, not even the anti-Semitism prevention coordinator, you know what I mean? Like... just a really absurd idea. And they're like, just, okay, we're only going to hire somebody that's going to work on anti-Semitism stuff. And there was some pushback on that. And now there's a sort of slate of discrimination prevention coordinators. But what isn't clear from the bill, and again, a lot of things are not clear in the bill, and we can talk about how that bill was passed. It was, you know, a really horrific process that basically circumvented every single procedural rule. One of the many things that's missing from that bill is we don't know how those discrimination prevention coordinators are going to be assigned, right, or identified. And it could be the case that they're political appointees. And if that's the case, right, it's very easy for one, you know, whoever governor or whatever it may be to assign somebody that has, say, a perception that Palestinian flags are anti-Semitic, right? And we have no real control over that. And so one of the other really big requests that this coalition of organizations has made, in addition to, you know, removing the references to the U.S. national strategy to counter anti-Semitism, is also that these discrimination prevention coordinators need to be career civil service positions, right? They need to be people who are actually grounded in and experienced in preventing discrimination, right? Not political appointees who have a specific agenda based on, you know, whoever happens to be appointing them. That could, you know, change overnight when the next political, you know, the next group of politicos come in and decide that they have a different political perspective on what those things can be. That's, as you can imagine, wildly dangerous, right? We're seeing it now in the ways that the Trump administration is using the phrase anti-Semitism to, you know, attack universities and deport students and things like that. So the fact right. that we are openly inviting that into our schools in California, it's bonkers.
What are there any other provisions that have raised concern, Samir?
Yeah, I'd say there's one other really key one, which is that One of the things that AB715 calls out directly is the bill specifically states that teachers are limited to what they call factually accurate, lesson materials. And this is something that as soon as that language was added into the bill, like all of the teachers' unions, everyone, you know, every like scholar of like education, whatever, was in an uproar because like, what, how do you define factually accurate, right? There's so much in school that is taught that is amorphous, right? That is complex, that has dimensions to it. And like, who is the arbiter of what is factually accurate or not, right? And the presence of that language is really, really concerning, and I think raises a lot of really big issues. And just to give you an example of how that applies, in the previous revision of AB 715, so not the one that passed, but the language in the bill that was there, you know, like days, literally days before it passed, one of the things that it referenced as being factually inaccurate was saying that Israel is a settler colonial state.
Right.
Well, if you call Israel a settler colonial state, you were violating the factually accurate standard that AB 715 is setting. Even though, like, I don't know, it seems very clear to me that Israel is, in fact, a settler colonial state. I think most scholars of settler colonialism would also agree with that. But again, who sets that standard, right? Like, what does factually accurate mean in this situation? What it really means is, you know, again, the dictates of, you know, a small group of politicians who are trying to carry out a political agenda. So that language needs to be removed, right? Or at the bare minimum, substantially revised.
So is it still in the bill?
The factually accurate piece is still in the bill, but the example about Israel being a settler colonial state has been removed.
Right. So there was concern about referring to what is currently happening to Palestinians with apartheid. And
that's right.
You know, and so there was a big battle about that. And there were accusations that referring to apartheid in Israel in the same breath was anti-Semitic.
That's right.
Right? Even though, you know, Israel dragged its feet, if it even actually came out and condemned what was going on in South Africa at the time, because that was a big debate when we were on campus.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, the U.S. and Israel in lockstep in not condemning this horrific way of governing. Mm-hmm. And then when we saw the passport laws and all these different types of things, different IDs, you know, that Palestinians are required to have. And, you know, if you don't have one, you can't be in this area. It's like, looks like apartheid, smells like apartheid, must be apartheid. Exactly. But saying that was somehow in violation. So where did that stand and what's the deal with that now?
Yeah, I mean, that. I think you're pointing to the exact example for why AB 715 is such problematic legislation, right? And, you know, what we've created is an environment in which if a teacher makes that comparison, right, or even if a teacher doesn't do enough to stifle students from making that comparison, that the whole school could be in trouble. And, you know, this comes in the face of, as you said, right, Israel was arming and protecting the South African apartheid government. In fact, they were trying to give them nuclear weapons
yeah.
Right before they fell. And the, like, apartheid activists in South Africa themselves have said multiple times, including, like, Desmond Tutu, what's happening in Israel is apartheid. And in many ways, it's worse, right? And you can actually maybe see, obviously, this is radio so no one else can see, but on the wall behind me is a Nelson Mandela quote, "Our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians." But God forbid you say that in a classroom, you know? It's a quote from Nelson Mandela, but you still can't say it. And so, you know, the authors of this bill have argued time and time again, and Gavin Newsom himself has said time and time again that this bill is not designed to suppress Palestinian speech, and it's not designed to suppress criticism of Israel. And if that's true, then they need to revise the bill to make that clear, right? And I think we all, you know, again, look at the example that they took out from the bill about you can't call Israel a settler colonial state.
So when these definitions came about, who was at the table to define this?
Great question. Great question. And one of the really big problems with how AB 715 was drafted is it was done without the input of teachers, of school boards, and of students, the three groups of people that you think would be key to drafting education legislation like this. And in fact, you know, the way that California legislation is supposed to be drafted is, you know, you present legislation, there's time for public comment. You know, there's supposed to be, I think, like 2 weeks for public comment, and then there's debate on the floor. It has to go through the appropriate committees, including, like, you know, the education committee if it's an education bill. And that's ostensibly the time where there's public consideration of what's supposed to be happening in this bill in the ways that it can actually be accountable to people on the ground. Obviously, even when that process works, that doesn't mean that that's how it turns out. But this time, that process was completely circumvented, right? The language in this bill was introduced a week after the deadline, a week after the deadline for submitting new legislation, which meant that, you know, this was right like days before the California legislature closed for summer recess. So that meant there was no public comment, none. The committees that it was supposed to go through ended up not having any vote. Like, they still sort of presented at the committees, but as like a gesture of good faith without letting them actually say anything about it. And this was, you know, the chair of the education committee in the assembly was like, we weren't consulted on this at all. This was absolutely wild and totally inappropriate that you did this. And said, if I could, I would vote no. But he didn't even have a vote.
Wow.
And so just barreled through in a way that even the authors of the bill and most of the people who voted for it openly said, this bill is really not finalized. The language in it is problematic and needs to be revised. They said that there would be what they called, and this is a quote, an ironclad commitment to amend the language in the bill to deal with some of the issues that students, teachers, school boards, parents have all brought up. And we're still waiting for that ironclad commitment to come through, right? The new legislative session, like, they're back from summer recess, right? The time to be doing that is right now. And this is an opportunity to show if they really cared about having a consultative process that included all of these people, then they could include them in this amendment process. And we haven't seen anything like that yet.
Who's been holding up the gear, so to speak? Who's stopping this ironclad commitment from happening?
That's a great question. And I can't tell you definitively because, you know, it's like a bill that's been signed, right? So it doesn't technically sit on anyone's desk right now. But I will say that the authors of the bill, right, assembly members Addison Zwer, and then the like sort of folks who have been cheerleading that bill, critically State Senator Scott Wiener and assembly member Jesse Gabriel, have all been on record as like strong advocates of this bill and also acknowledge that the bill needs fixing. So I would say those four people in particular should be considered to be on the hook for these commitments. And I think anyone who is a constituent of those four people should probably make it known that they have that expectation from them right now. Because it's really unacceptable, right, that they've made these promises and now they're just sort of ignoring them.
Sam Samar Arebe is our guest this afternoon from AROC and AROC Action. And as we wrap up, the word, Zionism. So saying Zionism has been, or being critical of Zionism, has been targeted as being anti-Semitic. And it's very interesting because there's a lot of, obviously, Jewish folks who are very clear that they're not Zionists and this doesn't really roll down that path and they're not in agreement. So how have we gotten there? And what's the difference between me being critical of, say, Catholicism or Christianity or any other religion, or me being critical of the Democrats or the Republicans or the Green Party or any number of political organizations? How did Zionism become this anti-Semitic word if you were critical of it?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I we're in this weird moment, right, where that oversimplification and that sort of conjuncture of those two ideas, right, the Jewish community and Zionists, is deliberately being blurred by people who are defending the state of Israel. And it's, you know, I think it's really critical that people understand Zionism is a political philosophy, right? That is open to criticism by anybody, given that it has real world political implications. And in fact, when Zionism was first sort of presented within the Jewish community, it was widely opposed by the Jewish community themselves, right? So like, now we live in it's really hard to know, you know, what the relationship is between the Jewish community and Zionism. But an increasing number, and particularly younger Jewish folks, but increasing number of Jewish folks generally, are rejecting Zionism wholeheartedly. So, like, we definitely can't equate Jews with Zionism, nor can we equate Zionism with Jews, right? I think it's also critical to remember, I would say very likely, the overwhelming majority of Zionists in the United States are not Jewish, right?
Right.
Not even remotely. They're mostly evangelical Christians, right? And their motivations for the success of the State of Israel, you know, are sort of based in this millenarian, like, apocalyptical vision of, like, this is how the world ends. And so, you know, it's wild that those people who are frankly often right-wing racists, right, very openly.
And very anti-Semitic.
Oh, deeply, deeply
anti-Semitic. I mean, you have people like Steve Bannon who routinely use a trope that has been, you know, deemed anti-Semitic when he talks about the globalists. So instead That's of exactly saying Jews, right. instead of saying Jews are taking over the world, they say the globalists,
yeah.
right?
Exactly
and,
right.
You know... And I was taught a long, long time ago, that's just a code word. But
absolutely.
This brings up the complications then, right? Why aren't they smashing on folks in this administration that are very clearly, in their wording and actions, anti-Semitic?
Yeah.
They pulled out all the stops to shut down encampments and to bring to bear anybody who associated themselves with the Palestinian solidarity movement. We see in England, if people say that you're for Palestine and you quote an organization, you know, you're in handcuffs.
That's right.
Yet Tucker Carlton and Candace Owens and Nick Fuentes, and we can go down the list, are very
right.
clear about where they stand, and they say some pretty horrific things, and nobody's really coming after them. About the most they'll say is they'll call them the woke right, but yeah. then those folks are sitting up there advising the president. So I'm really confused, and don't get me started on Elon Musk, Nazi
exactly.
salute, which the
exactly.
ADL said was not a Nazi salute.
But that, I mean, that's the answer to the question, right? That they clearly don't care about anti-Semitism. Their interest is not, in fact, in keeping the Jewish community safe. Their interest is in protecting Israel, right? And in making sure that Israel stays a strong imperial power that keeps everybody else subjugated, and that that same discourse can be used to keep left movements in the United States criminalized and under a boot. That's it, right? There's no other explanation for why the Anti-Defamation League is in cahoots with a man who's doing Nazi salutes and instead spending all of their time attacking Jewish kids on school campuses. You know, like, there's no other explanation for that. And I think that explanation is very clear, right? This is a discourse of power. It has nothing to do with community safety. And by the way, that's a tale as old as time, right? This isn't new as it relates
right.
to Jews and Zionism, right? This is like the discourse of community safety is the exact same thing that's being used to attack trans folks, right? It's the exact same thing that was used to, you know, attack black and brown communities in the United States throughout its history. It was used, like, to justify slavery. These ideas have very deep roots in the United States. And so, like, it's really important yeah. for us to pull
and
that discourse apart.
Right, and it's really about power, as you said,
exactly.
power and oppression at the end of the day. Samir, as we wrap up, what would you ask people to do? Is there a way to be involved? Is something that people should be reading? Is there a lever of power to pull?
Yeah, I mean, get organized, right? Like, I think a lot of organizations, AROC Action among them, is really building up to use these, like, upcoming 2026 elections as a real bellwether for what we're willing to put up with and what we're not. And I think this is a really key moment for folks to make their opinions clear to their legislators. But this sort of, like, political censorship is not okay, right? It's particularly in this moment of growing authoritarianism, it's really not okay. And there are ways in which we can push back. And, you know, the AB 715 passed, but it's a very different bill than it was when the authors first wrote it. And a big part of those changes is a result of community pressure. And that's not over yet, right? There's still a lot that can be done. And so I would really encourage folks to do what they can.
Samir Arabi, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. We will be on the lookout and keep our shoulder to the grind. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah.
Palestine, amid imperial colonial war. I greet you all, especially Sister Rabab, who invited me to join you, all of you, several weeks ago. So I greet you all. Marhaba. When we think of Palestine today, our minds fly naturally to the last few years of carnage that has cost, at the very least, 70,000 lives, those of men, women, and children, and over 90% of Palestinian buildings and structures in Gaza destroyed by Israeli and U.S. bombs. But I think it important to turn our eyes away and turn back the clock and calendar almost 100 years ago when the British gave its imprimatur to land transfers from Arabs to Jewish immigrants from Europe. When the British Empire held lands under its League of Nations trusteeship, the forerunner to the United Nations. There we see the imperial beginnings to this crisis to come. On November 2nd, 1917, Arthur James Balfour, the Earl of Balfour, wrote a letter to Lionel Walter, Lord Rothschild, the following. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and well use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine, or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. You've been listening to what has been called the Balfour Declaration of 1917. At the time, Britain held sway over one of the largest empires on earth, with lands in North America, Africa, and Asia, not to mention vast holdings scattered throughout the seas, like islands. Does it not really surprise us that they offered not a foot of land in Europe? From that day to this, Palestinian lands have been stolen, their holdings denied, and their farmlands whittled away. It is impossible to look at this as anything other than an imperial and neo-colonial conspiracy designed to prejudice the rights of the Palestinian people. How could Israel violate international law for almost a century with the United Nations looking the other way? This happens because we misunderstand the role really played by the UN, the successor to the failed League of Nations. Fortunately, Frantz Fanon, in his Toward the African Revolution, explains, we can say that two mistakes were simultaneously committed by the Africans. First of all, by Lumumba himself, when he asked for the intervention of the UN. The UN has never been capable of validly settling a single one of the problems raised before the conscience of man by colonialism. And every time it has intervened, it was in order to come concretely to the rescue of the colonial power of the oppressing country. That's Fanon. Fanon, this man whose mind pierced into the very core of reality, understood the central nature of the UN and wrote as follows. In reality, the UN is the legal card used by the imperialist interests when the card of brute force has failed. Fanon. Fanon wrote these insights in the wake of the betrayal and assassination of Congolese leader Patrice Lumumba. Lumumba's first great mistake, he noted, was his trust in the West and the UN. It cost him not only his life, but the collective lives and futures of the people of the Congo. We ponder these developments in light of the creeping occupation of Palestine and its territories, itself a violation of international law as well, as the emergence of Israel as a de facto regional hegemon in the Middle East. Some have likened the Zionist state to an aircraft carrier. Think of that. A weapon of war, indeed, a weapon of mass destruction in the region. The 1,000 plus years of European oppression of Jews is being paid by Arabs in Palestine. For Europe is the site of repeated Jewish expulsion, traumatization, and, as the German experience has shown us, genocidal destruction of Jews en masse. These historical experiences have created an intense otherness in Jewish consciousness that makes the extreme seem perfectly normal, for extremity has become normalized. This means that in order to mitigate its own otherness, the Jewish state had to make the leap from former British colony to an entity which exercised colonial power, which is to say, it had to act like a European power. How was this done? They had to treat the Palestinians, the indigenous people of the land, as others. This they have done since, indeed before, the establishment of Israel in 1948. I suggest here that much of the psychological energy fueling Israel is a hunger to really become something that it never was in over a millennia in Europe, European. Much of that energy has been projected upon the Palestinians rather than their true historical enemies, Europeans. State power supported by the purchase and manufacture of weaponry, has given it the ability to make psychological energy into reality in the real world today. Cameroonian scholar Achille Mbembe, in his now classic work, Necropolitics, examines the underlying conflicts between states and colonies thusly. Colonies are similar to frontiers inhabited by quote-unquote savages. Colonies are not organized as a state form and do not create a human world. The armies do not form a distinct entity, and their wars are not wars between regular armies. They do not imply the mobilization of sovereign subjects, what are called citizens, who respect each other as enemies. They do not establish a distinction between combatants and non-combatants, or, again, between an enemy and a criminal. Concluding peace with them is thus impossible. In sum, colonies are zones in which war and disorder, internal and external, figures of the political stand side by side or alternate with each other. The colony is thus the site par excellence where controls and juridical control and guarantees of judicial order can be suspended. The zone where the violence of the state of exception is deemed to operate in the service of quote-unquote civilization. Mbembe, page 77. What we see in Mbembe's citation is the colonization, otherization, and depersonalization of Palestinians, even as the state eats and encroaches on indigenous lands of Palestinian people. The recent war against Hamas was, in fact, a war against Palestinians, as evinced by the death of some 70,000 souls in Gaza. That colonial versus the colonized dialectic discussed by Mbembe is the roadmap of a territorialization of oppression. For nearly a century, Palestine has been under attack. They are still under attack, just by more violent means today. They struggle on, as they must do, even as their present life is truly the wretched of the earth. And speaking of Fanon's masterwork, the only solution to such a state is ceaseless struggle against the colonizer until it is no more. For only then can a new independent nation be born to give voice and place to the wretched of the earth. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu Jamal. Thank you.
Image out of my heart when we've seen the bodies found in a mountain of parts. Netanyahu told you just another child of the dark. Clear it's gonna take much more than thousands to march, more than a speech, more than a poem, more than a track of music. Gonna take more than a sit down with Bassem Youssef. Even bringing back ambassadors is an act that's useless, long as you pump oil for Apaches and the tanks they're using. Freedom just beyond reach for people you cannot see. He's wheezing and cannot breathe and screaming through the concrete, looking for his four children. The bombs leave structures that I wouldn't want to call buildings. My fingers pointed at this government, you all killed them. Tell me that you wouldn't take up arms if those were your children. Let me make the factor clear, the bombs were manufactured here, and they want the land as theirs because of natural gas in there. Feel death in the atmosphere while we hapless stand and stare, and a little boy begs for his brother's strand of hair. Truth is, I don't know how anyone can live after digging for their dead kids buried under bricks. Israel is a terror state, terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televise, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
Palestine.
They're not prepared to face the pain, so they're scared to say your name.
From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. From the river to the sea, free, 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 free. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. From the river to the sea, free, 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 free.
They bomb churches and paramedics, it's hurting. The panic spreading, hospitals where the doctors do C-sections, no anesthetics. The pressure is manifesting, humanity stands connected. Masses seem apathetic and actually just accept it. When our grandchildren ask us, what did we do to stop it? I'm determined to say, I did more than make music on it. That's why we shut down arms factories, you can try stopping us. Palestine action's the opposite of white phosphorus. We tell them on the television, but they never listen. Tell Piers Morgan that resistance isn't terrorism. They want them fled or missing, death or prison, endless killing. I seen a father hold his baby up, the head was missing. Imagine demolition of home where your parents living. Kings won't say a thing, but at least we know that Yemen's with them. Ethnic cleansing, it ain't hard to see the stages, but Gaza is a graveyard of the invaders. Ears close to the savagery, clear though when there's clarity. The journalists and doctors are heroes of humanity. As sordid and as gory as this story is for now, and they depopulating Gaza for Ben-Gurion's canal. Israel is a terrorist state, terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televise, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die.
Hard knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk, don't stop. E-Man at it again, Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Cam, yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation, simulation, step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out Anita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though.
Yeah.
Oakland stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on, check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Ain't nothing they made, they beats trying to eat till it ain't from the steel grave. Beats say, please, baby, they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say, peace to the lovers, I need with a please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go. Hey, we need David G.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
In the realm of the airwaves, where the truth does spin.
Hard Knock Radio takes the mic. Let the dialogue begin.
From the heart of the culture, where the beats do sway.
Hip-hop, pop, politics, and culture
rule the day.
Rock it on your radio.
Hard Knock, rock it on your radio.
Hard Knock, rock it on your radio.
Speaking truth to power.
Hard Knock, rock it on your radio. Hard Knock, rock it on your radio.
Truth, power.
Hard Knock rocking on your radio. Hard Knock rocking on your radio.
Due to unprecedented civil unrest, all forms of protest are now classified as acts of terrorism. This is not a test. This is not a test.
Coward, traitor, liar, foe, grabber, tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line them up like dominoes. Never bow to a in a toupee, yelling free speech, but controlling what the news say. The Lorax called, it's time to find a new shape. RuPaul's never seen a beat that bad on Drag Race. Ain't it obvious the person in the office is a racist? Brad came in the mail, but he opposes immigration. And someone's apple leader, not a foreign armed invasion. That would be the mass man ridden graduation ceremonies. I'm Mark Van, snatching people off the street. Broken Amendments 5, 10, and 14, at least. But please tell me again, oh, this is still democracy?
Repeat. This is not a test.
Coward, traitor, liar, foe, grabber, tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line them up like dominoes. Coward, traitor, liar, foe, grabber, tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line them up like dominoes. Please explain it to me. The man in charge of the economy's got 6 bankruptcies. Huh? Asking ChatGPT to define GDP, to fund an education when half the country can't read. Well, now it's clicking for me. You need the people asleep. And knowledge is the greatest threat to propaganda machines. Remember, books don't burn, they just quietly vanish. So don't wait till it's too late to panic. Iceberg, Titanic, threat level orange. Don't you see that they're ignoring our rights? It's fascism wrapped in red, blue, and white. Coward, traitor, liar, foe, grabber, tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line them up like dominoes. Coward, traitor, liar, foe, grabber, tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line them up like
dominoes.
It's a threat level orange.
Warning.
It's a threat level orange.
Warning.
It's a threat level orange. Red level orange. The American dream's like any other. Open your eyes and it's gone.
Listeners, sponsored stations count on you, not Arbitron. So when you push their buttons, you get radio that turns you on.
Hi there, this is Ann Feeney, and you are listening to listener supported community radio, KBOO FM in Portland.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. In December 2015, artist Jane Kim completed a massive painting about the wonders of birds.
So the Wall of Birds is an interior mural located at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's Visitor Center. And this mural is meant to celebrate the evolution and diversity of birds.
It depicts nearly 250 life-size birds and several of their ancient predecessors on a map of the world where each lives. Jane worked closely with the Cornell Lab to ensure that each portrait is scientifically accurate.
And so some of the birds I definitely have in their calling posture because I think that bird is so known for their calls, like the three-wattled bellbird is like an absolute stunner. But that particular call is just bonkers. I mean, it is a bonk. It is like a literal bonk. The wood warbler has its mouth open, calling out. Or the lyrebird. How can you not be enchanted by the lyrebird?
In Australia, the superb lyrebird waves his elaborate tail feathers overhead. In North America, a Carolina wren tilts an open bill to the sky. All across the map is a world full of bird song.
I really hope that the call looks like it's, you can hear it, the action of it in the painting.
For Bird Note, I'm Nick Byard.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre. A place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition. Tune into